Well, good afternoon, everybody. On Target St. John's, and our special in-studio guest this afternoon is Memorial University political scientist Kelly Bladuc. Hello, Kelly.
Hi, great to be back.
Thanks for coming, and I understand you had a little bit of a wrestle coming through the traffic today.
Kenmount Road and everything around it does not work right now, so yeah.
Well, you
avoid
made it
if
here.
You can.
You made it here by the skin of your teeth, and I really appreciate the effort put into that. And you know, well, he knows, nobody else knows, but he knows that I've been harassing him for several weeks now, trying to get him in to talk politics in Newfoundland and Labrador, because it is a blood sport, and we do love our politics in this province. And I wanted to talk to you a little bit about, in particular, politics as a whole, but the week that was, and it was an unusual week in the House of Assembly this week. What did you make of what happened there with the point of privilege debate?
Sure. So, you know, just to sort of recap, it was actually the previous week, right at the end of the previous week, where Minister Jerry Byrne had made comments about two opposition members, in both cases saying things that typically we would think of as unparliamentary. In one case, suggesting that somebody was possibly a criminal, and in the other, suggesting that somebody was essentially a racist. And so the parties showed up this week, of course, with a shorter sitting week because Monday was off. And but sort of first thing on Tuesday, there was a point of privilege put to the speaker asking to deal with this issue. This shouldn't have happened. And of course, the speaker decided to let this go forward. And there was a motion that was put forward by the PCs, which basically asked that the statements be withdrawn, that there be an apology, and that the minister spend time taking a course. I think 20 hours, I forget what exactly the type of course, but basically a lot of people were saying, well, this is kind of pointless anyways, and whether it would have ever happened. But they spent close to two sitting days debating whether that motion should be passed or not passed. And it would have actually been fascinating if they had stuck with it, because the nature of the House is such that the Liberals don't have a majority. They can't just say, well, it's one of our people, we're going to support them, and this will be over. And also, every single member gets an opportunity to speak for, I believe it's 20 minutes, which across 40 people is a lot of time to take up. And then, of course, you have breaks and everything else. So they ate up a lot of time with a lot of people talking about it. The whole thing was really quite crazy. And ultimately, the Premier came forward with an amendment after, again, like a long time later, came forward with an amendment to this motion, basically saying so long as the minister withdraws his statements, which he then did. I mean, there's a lot of different ins and outs here that I think could all have their own discussions. I personally don't understand why it was necessary for the Premier, who could have told him to withdraw the statements at the very beginning of all this, to come forward with an amendment. Now, I've talked to different people about it who say, well, you know, the opposition parties want the, you know, a minister or the Premier to come forward and try to save face and whatever else. And I personally don't see it. I think, honestly, the minister could have gotten up and withdrawn his statements before this was even necessary. If not, I think he could have made an offer to withdraw them along the way. I don't know why his boss had to present this amendment in front of everybody when he could have actually just told him to do it. To me, it speaks to weakness. It speaks to ineptness. And ultimately, yes. So in a week in which they only had three sitting days, they used two of them to deal with a badly behaving minister, a minister who said stuff that he shouldn't have said. And he found himself praising himself when it was all done. Apparently, he had accomplished something wonderful that couldn't possibly have been accomplished through any other means. I won't use the words I would. Anyways, it's not smart. Let's go with not smart.
Was it time wasted?
It was time wasted. But beyond time wasted, I think what bothers me the most about this is, so I study representation. I study, I focus mostly on Ottawa and a little bit on other countries. I'm not really so much into the province and the provinces, but I am very interested in people being represented and people also feeling some kind of a trust or connection with the people who represent them, and also with the government more generally. And to spend 2 days doing this diminishes the nature of the House. I mean, it's the people in it doing it. They're diminishing it. They're making it worse. But I realize that I'm one of the few people who actually has sympathy for these people. Most people don't. And all this does, I'm with them, they shouldn't have sympathy for these people. These people are acting like idiots. They're wasting our time and they're wasting our money. And if you want to be angry about it, go ahead and be angry about it, because these people deserve it. The next time you see them, tell them to smarten up. I don't understand why they would invite, why they would behave that way and invite, you know, the criticism that's going to necessarily come from it, and just continue to diminish something that is actually the heart of our democracy. And I realize that sounds like a cliche, but it is. It should be something that we can look up to. It should be a place where the people in it, you know, rise to the occasion, not fall to it. And that's all they did this week. They fell.
The minister, as you indicated, congratulated himself for accomplishing, ostensibly, I suppose, discussing racism on the floor of the House of Assembly. Was there a better way to have done that?
I think under the circumstances. So, of course, we also have Chief Joe who said that he was, you know, happy that it came forward, that it was raised in the House. Now, I can understand that. I think this is an issue that can and should be raised in the House. But what bothers me is that this was an issue that happened a long time ago. This was taken, obviously, out of complete opportunism to wait as long as he did to kind of say, okay, now we've got a member of the NDP who I can try to chastise in the House about this during question period so I cannot answer questions about something that matters. None of that should be acceptable. That's crazy. And I guess I go beyond that. So I'm saying, you know, now that Chief Joe has said he's willing to actually address the House, and it's like this, there's this opportunity to talk about racism, which I think should be talked about in the House, to suggest that there wasn't an opportunity for this to occur prior to all this is insane. So we have Perry Trimper in the House. We had all that went down with that. If we wanted to address racism in the House and invite our Indigenous leaders to speak in the House, they should be invited. It does not take a minister acting like an idiot to make that happen.
And of course, Leila Evans with the opposition was quick to point that out in the first session of question period, a Tuesday session, which started on Thursday. And that was the first question she put. She said, if racism is really what we want to talk about here, what's Perry Trimper still doing in the caucus?
Sure. And you know what? I think there needs to be space for people to make mistakes and to have, and for there to be apologies. I can understand where she's coming from. I'm not saying it's right or it's wrong. I'd rather not pass a particular judgment on that, because I don't honestly know the right way to build things back from where they've gone. You know, rather than speak to whether Perry Trimper should even be in the House, I think more importantly, we can say, though, that there are opportunities for the House to deal with issues of racism, to deal with reconciliation, a rebuilding of relationships with Indigenous people. But again, it doesn't require bringing up an issue from the past to attack somebody within the House by the minister during question period for any of that to happen. The government, if it wants to deal with this, can deal with it. They're front and center. They have the opportunities. They could certainly put a motion forward in the House and say, should we invite an Indigenous leader to come and speak to us? And I'm sure they'd get unanimity on it. It wouldn't be hard to do. So anyways, I'm sorry. It all bothers me so much. I feel like I'm stuttering more than usual or sputtering or something. I find the avenues that people are using with their little political games to be beneath the House, beneath the nature of our democracy, and really a disservice to citizens who have to look at this and listen to this and take it as though it's somehow meaningful when people are saying things that don't make sense.
Memorial University political scientist Kelly Bladuc is my in-studio guest on Target St. John's. We'll be back right after this. And we're back. Memorial University political scientist Kelly Bladuc is my in-studio guest, and I've been trying to get you in for a little while now to talk politics, and it's really timely now because we've had this really unusual week in the legislature this week. We've only got, I think it's 3 weeks this fall, and 1 week, for all intents and purposes, is gone now. Mm-hmm. And the big issue that sparked all of this was a very intense line of questioning towards the minister regarding the salmon die-off, a huge event. It has environmental, economic, and perhaps climactic implications there. Very serious incident, and this is what comes out of it, this 2 days of debate on a point of order of name-calling, I suppose, mm-hmm. what it comes down to. So what was the minister's responsibility in all of that, if any?
So, I mean, the point of having the House open and having question period in it is to hold the government to account. And so, I mean, question period, of course, a lot of us look at it. It's theater. There's a lot that goes on with it. A famous cabinet minister at the federal level years ago used to, not a cabinet minister, actually, before he, when he was in opposition, he would kind of look at questions and say, well, we're not going to ask any questions unless they embarrass the government. It doesn't matter how good they are. It doesn't matter if they're things we need answered. It matters whether they can embarrass people. So, you know, I mean, this is the nature of question period, and we kind of recognize that. It still serves an important purpose, which is that each day that the House sits, the government has to get up and give account for the things that are asked. And they don't get notice of the questions. It's actually, in some ways, a very valuable avenue, but it doesn't usually work that well. Most of the questions aren't that valuable, most of the things that happen, but it does also mean that when things are going on, we really can hold the government to account. And I think this happens to be one of those issues where we want to know more and we feel like we haven't really been told, as things occurred, what exactly was going on with the die-off and what was going on with the cleanup. What was the scope of it? And then beyond that, it's how did this happen, right? So these are important questions, and these are important questions not just for the particular case, but if this is an industry that matters, we have a lot of employment that currently in it and that could be in it, and it's something that we actually want to develop, we need to kind of look at and say, well, where were the balls dropped? How did we end up, you know, at a smaller scale? How, you know, think of Muskrat Falls, right? Like, what were the costs? What were the things we could have done better? These are important questions to ask, and so the legislature is the one place they can be asked, and the government should get up and be able to answer for them. And again, that brings me back to my frustration with the minister, is that he took this as an opportunity on that particular issue to throw things off the rails, just not answer questions, just attack people, bring up things that, granted, might be relevant, but are not relevant in that particular setting. And so, yes, anyways, I mean, his responsibility in a pure sense is to answer those questions, to give his honest answers as best as he can. And if things went wrong, to be able to say so or to try to figure out what they are. But that wasn't the avenue that he took. He took instead, he decided to attack people. And of course, yes, we wasted a bunch of time because of it.
And this is a public process. It's the legislature. It's a public legislature. It's the people's house, like we like to refer to it.
It
that is. Sort of changed somewhat when they started putting restrictions on who can go in and who can't. But that's understandable in this day and age, some would argue. But it is the people's house. It's an open forum. Some would argue, well, you know, media can ask those questions. Well, sure, media can ask those questions too, but ministers are not always available. And you can't just, you know, camp outside someone's house waiting for them to answer a question. So this is the opportunity, as you've indicated, for the opposition ostensibly to hold government account.
Yeah, and I mean, you're right. I mean, I think that the media plays a big role here too, and the media has played a big role. The media has done what they can. They've certainly also, I mean, you know, sort of the positives and the negatives. They've also gotten attacked a bit for what they've done. But at the end of the day, there needs to be a setting in which there isn't the sort of the shouting, the choice of who to answer and who not to answer, and that's what the question period does. It identifies one person to ask a question, one person to answer it, and that person ideally will provide an answer. Now, I mean, you know, if we're talking about question period more generally, I'd also say, you know, going back to the original point I was making at the start, sometimes the questions are designed a certain way too. And that's a fair point. We can't always just say, well, they're not answering the questions. You should also, you know, I think be critical of the types of questions that get asked. But in this case, I don't think that that was really the problem. I think if you go back and take a look, he was being asked a question that was direct. It was about something of substance, and it was something he had the opportunity to answer and chose not to do it. So, yeah, if we want things to work better, again, going back to all my frustration about this, if we want the House to work, if we want people to respect it, if we want people to say, hey, you know, our democracy works, as opposed to, hey, something needs to change, it does require that when the House sits, it can do so with decorum. It can do so people are asking clear questions, giving providing answers that make sense, and properly holding governments to account. It'll be obviously political. It's not like people sometimes say things are too political. They'll be political. They'll always be political. There's power at play. There's electioneering going on. All those things are always going to be there. We can't get rid of them. But it does also require a little bit of just accepting that this is the way it needs to work. And the more that we work our way into attacks, the more that we work our way away from trying to provide information, it just makes the whole process work less. And who knows where that ends up. But the worst case scenario is we all just say, well, it's not worth it.
What role does the speaker play? Because I've heard some people say, well, some advantage was taken with a new speaker in the House getting used to the system and keeping everybody in line.
Sure. Yeah, no, I think there's more to this on that level, too. So I think the PCs took the approach of asking for a point of privilege, and some have argued instead this should have been a point of order. If it's a point of order, my understanding then the speaker is the one who makes a decision upon it. If you're asking for someone to withdraw comments, the speaker comes back and says, you're right, the person should withdraw the comments. That probably made the most sense here. Whether it was a point of privilege, I'm not perfectly clear, but my sense, certainly I might get some emails about this afterwards, my sense is that this isn't actually a case of privilege because what was said wasn't a breach of privilege. And when we talk about parliamentary privilege, this is the whole point of when someone is in parliament in their seat, they're actually allowed to say whatever they want. There are certain rules about swearing or pointing out that somebody else isn't there. But basically, you're allowed to make accusations. You are actually allowed to suggest that somebody might be a criminal. Whereas if you did that outside the House, you could be charged for doing so, or you could be, right? So it does provide certain safeties. What I mean about this then is I don't think anything that a parliamentarian can do or can say, there was no breach of that. Byrne was still allowed to say the things he said. Now, we would say under virtually any circumstances, they would be withdrawn. And the speaker would typically ask someone to withdraw them. But by going the avenue the PCs did, it required this debate where everybody gets to decide, everybody gets to give a little speech, and that's the reason why it was able to last 2 days. So yes, there's certainly games going on both sides. Certainly not the case that that anybody was doing this the right way. But it all was brought about by the minister in the first place. This opportunity was provided by not choosing to withdraw or not choosing to use the proper language in the first place. And it is unfortunate. I do think that at the end of the day, a simple withdrawal could have headed all this off at the pass, but considering it didn't, it gave the opposition an opportunity to, well, yeah, sort of further waste all of our time. If you're going to dig in, we're going to dig in too, was essentially what they said. So
much for a conciliary approach to a minority government situation. Is some of that being taken advantage of here too?
Sure. I guess just to the final point you said about the inexperience of the speaker, yeah, there may have been some of that. So I think that that's something that was being taken advantage of. I think that with when we get into minority situations, it's funny how we It's funny how we come off of an election and there's a minority parliament. It's happened federally as well. And immediately people say, well, you know, the people have sent them a sign. They want them to cooperate. They want them to get along better. That's why they, you know, chose a minority. Well, voters don't really choose a minority, but it's a result that requires some type of cooperation for bills to pass. But that doesn't mean that parties cooperate more. Typically, they actually cooperate less. They get cornered into positions where ultimately someone has to support the government, etc. But what it also does is it gives us uncertainty in terms of the timing of the next election. And that thrusts us into, I mean, there's been a lot of research in recent years that I think really came out of the Harper years federally, where people talk about constant campaigns or permanent campaigns. I think partly parties have gotten more into the campaigning process. They're much more adept at it. We're constantly learning. We're getting better at it. But beyond that, the minority parliament kind of forces it. You don't know when the next election is going to be, so you're always campaigning. You're always fighting. You're always setting yourself up to how can I win more votes next time or make so-and-so lose more votes next time. And so that's why we don't see proper cooperation, is because parties are constantly fighting. They're constantly distinguishing. They're constantly saying, I'm not like you. And this is why hopefully next time people will see that you made a mistake and I didn't. So yes, if you're hoping that somehow parties would be nicer or they'd get along more or they'd be, you know, show up and they'd all be trying to figure out how they could work together, that's not how parliament works. And that's not how minority parliaments work, especially.
Because of the minority government situation, there's no doubt that there's a lot of strategizing that's taking place. I want to talk to you a little bit about that right after this. Kelly Bladuc, Memorial University political scientist, is my in-studio guest this afternoon. And we're back. Political scientist with Memorial University, Kelly Bladuc, is my in-studio guest, and it's been a very interesting week in the legislature this week. Some say it completely went off the rails with that point of privilege and the debate that followed. We're a little bit behind now. That means we're going to have to make this time up at some point. Is that correct?
I would guess so. So, I mean, I can't really speak to the exact things that need to happen and the exact time it would take to do them. People who are in the legislature, I'm sure, are keeping an eye on that. But yes, this definitely sets them back. If they had bills to pass and only 3 weeks in which to do them, well, you've just stolen, yeah, close to, well, more than 10% of your time, I guess. So that's a lot.
We are in this minority government situation, and whenever we're in these types of scenarios, people are always expressing a great deal of optimism. But there's a lot of strategizing that goes with that, and there's a lot of things that government perhaps will put up with reluctantly because they don't want to prompt another election. And we're in a very precarious kind of position, or a government is, in the House right now, because Andrew Parsons is not sitting in this particular session. And we've seen what happened this week. I mean, what kind of strategizing goes into that? And what does the Premier have to think about when, you know, important issues or crises, if you will, come up?
Well, I'd say on the front of trying to do what they need to do, I don't think they're particularly concerned about a confidence vote, but that would always be one of your front and center concerns if you're in a minority, is that you might actually see your government fall because the opposition votes against you. And the votes are actually there for that to occur. Considering the election was as recent as it was, and I don't imagine any of the parties are in a great financial position or really even in terms of their leadership, et cetera, there's probably a number of dynamics where they're saying, we wouldn't want to force an election, so we'll find a way to cooperate on things or get things done at the end of the day. We're not going to cooperate up to the point that we vote, but when the time comes to vote, we'll make sure that the bills pass, kind of thing. So I think that that's there. I think that, and I think that will certainly change. I think once we get past this, we get into next year. At that point, the likelihood of a non-confidence vote or something else increases, and that's where things will probably get even a little more snippy. But beyond that, at any given point in time, we may actually see the government fall. So those are that's sort of the biggest issue there. I guess beyond that is that the government still wants to pass its agenda to the extent that it can. You know, there are promises. There are things that they do actually kind of want to do. So keeping an eye on the clock, I don't know if that was happening earlier this week. I don't know what considerations were going on. I don't know what was happening behind the scenes in terms of who was being told to do what. But certainly the goal would be to get out there and show people that you can govern and they can trust you, because you used to be a majority, now you're a minority, you're clearly less popular than you were. Use the opportunities you can to show people why you deserve the reins again. And I don't feel any of that's happened so far, but that would be the main thing you're trying to do is can we use the time in the House to pass the bills or to, you know, forward the types of things on our agenda that we think are most beneficial?
Will the next budget pass, do you think?
I mean, I would guess that it would, barring something larger or more unforeseen than what we've had so far, something that would actually shake things up to the point where we could say, okay, so now we know, you know, for example, if there was a scandal on some, you know, big enough scale with a cabinet minister or somebody in the governing party, something that makes everybody think, hey, an election might actually be advantageous. Barring that, I think they'll find a way to pass whatever the next budget is. I think it's because it's, you know, typically would come sort of early spring in that time frame. Less than a year since the last election. And my guess would be the parties would try to see that go forward. What you often see, though, also is that the governing party will sort of force the destruction of the parliament. So they might do something that the other parties can't possibly vote for to say, well, then fine, then vote us out. But again, that would be a circumstance where the government felt it was advantageous to have the opposition parties vote against something so that they could go to an election on it.
That's provincial politics. Mm-hmm. Federally, we've got something very interesting happening now. It's an angry time. And the last federal election, divisive, there's no doubt about it. We've been talking a lot about regionalization, which a lot of people have argued we've always had regionalization. But for some reason, it's really become contentious this time around. And instead of Quebec being the one threatening to leave, it's now Alberta and this whole Wexit movement. What's Justin Trudeau got on his plate now? How should he move forward?
Justin Trudeau is in an interesting spot. I thought coming into this that the biggest question mark would actually be the pipeline. If it's a minority government, it's almost certainly Trudeau who's in charge of it. Can the pipeline sort of continue? At this point, the work is being done on it. The government owns it. It can continue, but The support for that government is dependent upon the NDP. In certain circumstances, if the NDP says we're not supporting you on anything, then the government would say, well, okay, well, we have to look at the Bloc, or we have to look at the Conservatives. The Conservatives aren't going to want to get along on much, because, you know, we sort of have these two main parties and then everybody else. The two main parties do what they can to not get along, to distinguish themselves. The Bloc would typically vote for things that the Bloc wants, but the Bloc is a Quebec party. They're looking for everything that Quebec can get, and they're also a separatist party. I mean, I think we forget that sometimes. We see a leader like Blanchette, who's actually kind of interesting. We kind of like him when we see him on TV. His goal is not to make the country better, regardless of the things that he says. Now, he may have, you know, certain policy positions people like. I shouldn't go too far down this road, but I mean, just thinking, you know, you brought up the issue of separation. I don't know how far or how serious the Western approach to this is. But it's clear that there's anger. It's clear that there's something that I'm not clear for myself that someone with the last name Trudeau could ever really fix that.
Indeed. That goes back many decades.
What could it include? I mean, certainly getting the pipeline in place will help if that's actually the goal. Whether that's the best for Canada or not, I think is still actually kind of an open question. But I think that would actually appease people to an extent, at least, to say, okay, so they did buy the pipeline, even though we don't maybe like all the other policies they have about the tankers. We don't like the bills that they've passed in terms of environmental policies. At least they have helped us move this oil, and that's probably the main thing. So I think that for Trudeau, that's important if his goal is to appease the West. It's not crystal clear to me that appeasing the West needs to be his top priority. And some people would get angry at me for saying that, I'm sure. Certainly Westerners were. I'm from BC originally too, so I do have a little bit of, you know, understanding. And I've spent some time in Alberta recently doing some studying there. So I'm sympathetic to the anger that exists there, even if some of it, I think, is misplaced. Trudeau, though, doesn't necessarily need people in Alberta or people in Saskatchewan to be supportive of him. Certainly, you wouldn't want to be the prime minister that saw the country break apart, but I think that there are limitations to the leverage that these Western provinces have in terms of separation. I think the anger is absolutely there. Whether that matters is a completely different thing. So I'm not going to say there's an obvious strategy here, but I would say that the idea that Trudeau needs to do something for Alberta is it's debatable.
Is there not some kind of an olive branch, though, that he can present or try to appease and try to get everybody more unified?
Sure. So I guess the question here then is, does he have to change policies that he campaigned on to keep people in Alberta happy? So, for example, if you're saying that you want to enhance the carbon tax and eventually move towards net zero in 2050, which, by the way, the Liberal Party of Canada will not do with the things they're saying they're going to do. But that aside, that's one thing they're saying they're doing. Now, if you were someone who was concerned about that, that would be worse, right? If they're saying, well, we're going to try to achieve this. You'd look at that and say, well, you have to do something different. And that's basically what they're trying to do. So if you're Trudeau, do you step back and say, okay, so I'm going to scale back on environmental policy? Well, that's a tough one. So, you know, sometimes people like to calculate how many people voted for the government versus didn't vote for the government. Well, if you look at people who voted for relatively environmental parties, I mean, the only party that took seats that didn't have an environmental policy equal to or greater than the Liberals, it's just the Conservatives. And they've got all the seats in Alberta and Saskatchewan. And what, 34% of the country. So what that suggests to you is about two-thirds of the country voted for parties with relatively strong environmental policies. So it's hard to kind of square that with, well, I need to do something for the concentrated conservative supporting Western provinces that want me to do something in the other direction.
And of course, it's a resource-based economy. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Based on the carbon.
Right.
So will we ever be able to, as you say, circle that square or square that circle?
You know, as much as it bothers me, if we think of sort of a middle of the road approach, I think that Trudeau has actually done the best that anybody's attempted to of doing that. He's basically said, we're going to build a pipeline in order to be more environmental. On the surface, that sounds crazy, right? there's an argument underlying it that I don't think is completely crazy. It's still a bit odd. It's that we're going to use what resources we have and put whatever we can from that to build ourselves towards an economy that doesn't depend on those resources. Okay, so we're going to sort of build up, become more dependent upon to not become dependent upon. But that's the approach he's chosen to take. I have a hard time thinking how you balance the interests in the country much better than that, and sort of play the, you know, the liberal, mushy middle of the road approach that liberals tend to take. So, I find myself almost reluctantly praising Trudeau for coming up with this. Even if it's not necessarily good policy, it's pretty good politics. The fact that it hasn't played well enough in Alberta is that there's still more to it. There is the other policies they've passed that people are concerned about. Going back to the original question, I just can't see that there's much more that you can do besides say, you know what, we're going to try to appease you by building the pipeline, but we're not going to really give you much more than that. That's the branch. That if you want olives, they're on that branch. That's it. There's nothing else.
There's been a lot of talk about leadership and Eddie Scheer. I keep saying that. I'm sorry, Eddie. Andrew Scheer. Whether or not the Conservatives could have made a bigger inroads under a different leader. People keep turning to Peter MacKay, who is more of that progressive conservative that a lot of Canadians might feel more comfortable with. I don't know. Mm-hmm. But what about the leadership of the Liberal Party? I mean, should Justin Trudeau consider himself to be in a bit of trouble here?
Yeah, he certainly should think of himself as being in a bit of trouble. He's less popular. People don't trust him the same way. I don't think there's probably an easy way to build any of that back up. That doesn't mean that the Liberals can't still succeed under him. I think that the likelihood of the Liberals succeeding with their current leader is higher than that of the Conservatives succeeding with theirs. I could be wrong, absolutely, but I just think that what we saw with Andrew Scheer and what we kind of all identified even in the leadership process that made him leader was that, if you will, the A-list of conservatives didn't come out for that leadership race. And at the time, it was considered that usually when a party wins a majority, especially when it's the Liberals, especially when it's a new, like a straight turnover as it was, it's unlikely that they're going to lose straight up the next election. That was the sort of the calculation that was made. I think that in this election, though, even though they still did manage to hold on with a minority, I think it did show that the weakness was there. And it's quite possible that a leader who could have answered questions more effectively, who didn't have some of the baggage and the inexperience that Scheer had, probably could have helped or convinced Canadians to vote for us instead. I just don't think he was able to do that. So, and I think that the fact that he wasn't able to do it under those circumstances shows why Scheer is a lot of people are saying he should probably move along. I don't think that Trudeau has quite those same problems. He was certainly painted as being inexperienced and just having nice hair and all these things, but then he became prime minister in 2015. And regardless of how you feel about him, he wasn't actually a terrible prime minister. He didn't do particularly well. He became less popular, but he's done it before. Yeah, the Liberals also, I think, it's just the fact that they are the closest to the center that we have for a major party. They remain the second choice for most Canadians that they aren't the first choice for. They sort of have a strength, I think, that the Conservatives just don't have. And so at this point, he's prime minister. It gives him the avenues and the opportunity to sort of build that back up. It probably won't ever be what it was in 2015. But yeah, he should be concerned. But at the same time, I don't think that he has the same problems or weaknesses. If he had been relegated to the opposition benches, we wouldn't see him anymore, though.
And we'll talk a little bit more about the Peter MacKay factor coming up right after this. Kelly Bladuc, Memorial University political scientist, is my in-studio guest. We'll be back. And we're back. Kelly Bladuc, Memorial University political scientist, is my in-studio guest. And during the break, we were talking about the dissolution of the Progressive Conservative Party on the federal election map. And a lot of people tend to wax nostalgic, I suppose, about that. They say we need another centrist, but more, conservative when it comes to fiscal policies rather than social policies. So we have a void on the federal front. Can we ever see a resurgence of the progressive conservatives? There's been a few attempts, I know, in the past 20 years or so, but can we expect to see that again someday?
I think it's probably unlikely. I mean, the one thing that they did, so going back in history a little bit, of course, yes, there was a Progressive Conservative Party led by Brian Mulroney, two majority governments in a row, but back in the days of constitutional amendments and so on, that fell apart. And then the Reform Party came along, and we've ended up now with this Conservative Party of Canada, which kind of enveloped this further right, Western-based politics. I think there is a bit of a void there. We were also kind of saying, someone like Peter McKay or someone like maybe Michael Chong, who could have potentially been a leader of that party, would have made it more progressive. Perhaps economically not so much, but socially I'd say for sure. I think that as much as some people really want those people to be leaders, I think it's highly unlikely that that party will ever elect those people to be leaders. I think that the strength in the party remains sort of with a certain element of social conservatism as well. And so those people will be looked on not too fondly by the membership itself, even if at the end of the day they'd have better electoral prospects were it to happen. It's really the membership that determines who gets to lead, but it's not the membership who votes. They vote in the election, but they're outnumbered by general citizens who aren't party members and who don't think that way. So, I guess what I'd say is it might be a reasonable strategy for the party to do that. But the one other thing beyond that is if you do vacate that space on the right, the social conservatism that currently the party still kind of straddles, it does open up the possibility that another party comes along, which is what happened in 1993, right? The West had voted overwhelmingly for Mulroney in the 88 election, but come 1993, almost all those seats went to the Reform Party. And the PCs began what was their slow death towards eventually merging, but really to a point, they just didn't have any power. They only won two seats in that election. So you could look at this most recent election, again, Maxime Bernier, the People's Party. They weren't successful. They really were, I think, less successful than a lot of people even thought they might be. No seats, very poor showings. But had a different leader been at the helm of the Conservative Party, had they been vacating that space a little bit more, it's possible that some people would have seen that as an option. I think as it was, people who are relatively right-leaning still see the Conservatives as their best hope. So that didn't open the door to a further right party. And so, yes, I it's kind of like, well, you're damned if you do and damned if you don't. If you remain too far right, you're not going to have a low likelihood of governing. If you move into the center, you may give up seats and also give up some space to a party that might get its foot in the door and actually start to whittle away at you.
Was it the Bloc factor that played a role in all of that as well? Because as we know, there is a huge number of seats in Quebec, and Quebec does what it does best, which is take care of itself. Mm-hmm. You can't blame them for that. I mean, I think most Newfoundlanders and Labradorians and Albertans for sure would agree that, anything that gets us what we need is going to succeed. So Quebec, with the emergence of the Bloc, the political landscape changed dramatically and has never gone back.
Yeah, and so Quebec has this weird volatility where we see almost election by election, they tend to change more than most provinces in terms of who they elect. I think in this last election, my sense is that the Bloc became a little bit more of a default. It was a little bit of a surprise that they were able to resurrect themselves. But I think the amount of time that they've had, since the 1990s, since that period when separatism was actually sort of the rage in Quebec, and it's not anymore, they were able to still sort of place themselves as the guardians of Quebec. And so when you get into an election and you're not too sure who you should support, Trudeau's losing popularity, the NDP has basically fallen apart there, the Conservatives have never actually been particularly popular in Quebec. They've done better, but they've never really been the big party there since, well, really going back to Mulroney again with the Progressive Conservatives. Yeah, the Bloc becomes a bit of a default. So even if people aren't fully comfortable with separatism or any of that, well, the Bloc says, well, we're not planning to do that anyways. Of course, we're the federal party. We can't be the ones to start a referendum regardless. And therefore,
they have a more softened approach to all of that now. I mean, the Bloc was punished in the last federal election. They've reemerged with this very charismatic leader, but they don't come across as hardline of that piquist kind of attitude that turned off a lot of people.
Yeah, and actually, I'd say a lot of that's credit to Gilles Duceppe, their previous leader. I mean, he was leader for a long time. He had his fingers on the pulse of Quebec for a long time. And of course, it was under him that they started to lose power, but people still trusted him. And they even brought him back. I don't know if you remember in 2015, he basically came back to lead the party briefly for the election, didn't win his seat, and then left again. And even that was seen as sort of helping them along. But he also espoused this idea. I remember him coming to Newfoundland and Labrador. He came and spoke to us at the university as he was trying to get into this sort of, if you will, sort of soft sovereignty approach, try to make people like the Bloc and not see them as the enemy, as though they were like they had to hate each other. It's an interesting strategy. It could be that that's partly why Quebecers have also come back around to it. It doesn't feel like they're doing something quite, it's not an affront to the rest of Canada to vote for the Bloc anymore. But also beyond that, I think that a lot of people just got tired of the referendum politics. And so long as the Bloc says, you know what, if you elect us, that threat's always in your pocket, but we don't have to use it. I think a lot of Quebecers are perfectly happy with that. And they're a big enough province that it matters that they have this. You could see similar dynamics in other provinces. You know, Alberta's going to have a Wexit party probably in the next election. I don't think as much attention will be paid to them. I doubt that they'll ever have the kind of impact.
Well, that was my next question. You know, can the Western alienation be addressed and satisfied? We only have 4 minutes left, so
sure.
There you go.
Sure, so it can't go in too many directions. Can it ever be satisfied? I don't think it's something that can ever be satisfied. I mean, Western alienation is something that is more than a century old. The idea of separation comes and goes. I remember people talking about it when I was young. I remember people talking about it when the Reform Party was just on the move. And of course, if you go back in time to the 1910, 1920s, you see Western politics coming up with their own parties, finding ways to try to say that the East, which of course for them includes everybody from Ontario over, just don't listen to us. They try to take advantage of us. I think that'll always be the case. I think that's the nature of the population to an extent, which will probably shift more to the West over time as it has. But it is substantially resource-based economy, and it probably never will have the power. And so there will always be this sense that we're too far away and the things that we do are valuable but not valued. And so that'll probably always be there. I don't know that going in the direction of separation really helps. I think it'll just exacerbate this problem of really what it comes down to, which is that provinces like Alberta, as much as they have economic clout, they really don't have much leverage. There's nowhere for them to go. Separation will not work for you, so you can threaten it all you want.
And hopefully they'll get over their anger towards us at some point, which I think struck a lot of Newfoundlanders and Labradorians as completely shocking. I mean, nobody, I don't think myself included, really understood the level of anger that was being felt in Alberta.
Yeah, now it's hard to say how many people, you know, sometimes loud people online are different than people generally.
The all-caps crowd,
worth keeping in mind as well. What I find interesting about all this, too, is that because we have a significant separatist party in Quebec again, one thing to keep an eye on is the degree to which that leader, you know, comes across as friendly and can work with Canadians, but ultimately might actually stoke anti-Quebec sentiment as well. I was kind of talking about this a little bit yesterday. If there's a province that's thinking it doesn't like Quebec and they're going to say that more and more, there's no reason why a leader of the Bloc shouldn't sort of help that happen. Their long-term goal is separation. If they can make it seem like we don't belong here, they'll do it. And beyond that, if the country breaks up, cool, that makes it easier for us to go. So I think those are things to keep in mind, that Quebec, Bloc Québécois party is... that's part of their long-term strategy. If they can just kind of poke the bear or poke the Alberta, you know, whatever, they'll do it.
Certainly, they're interesting times we're living in. I know we always say it, but there's always something new to talk about. And of course, whenever there's these kinds of things happening politically, it's good for you and it's good for us.
So lots to talk about.
Lots to dissect and help the public also try to understand what's really going on, as opposed to just venting on Facebook.
Right.
I suppose. Kelly Bladuc, thank you. Sorry for the harassment. really appreciate you taking the time here and beating the traffic to get in here. Once again, we'll have you in again, no doubt. I really appreciate the time that you've spent with us this afternoon. On Monday, I'm going to be talking with Stella Circle. Very interesting indeed. So tune in then on Monday at 1 o'clock. Thanks, everybody, for having a listen.